Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. On today's show, I speak with professor, scholar, and author Omar Aziz. That's coming up on Endeavors. Well, hi there. Happy Monday. And welcome to another episode of Endeavors. Hope those of you who are on spring break are enjoying yourselves and enjoying this sunny, sunny weather that we are finally getting. And speaking of finally, I'm finally back to a long-form interview. It's been a minute since I've done one of these. These are what I'm trying to gravitate more towards. I think it's just kind of better suited to the show that I want to do. That doesn't mean I will stop or say no to the shorter interviews and shows that have, you know, two or more interviews. But I'm really liking this sort of longer form structure of the show, which shouldn't come as a surprise considering my interview hero is James Lipton, late host of Inside the Actor Studio. So, with that in mind, I'm super, super excited about today's guest. You know, I often do like actors, writers, filmmakers, you know, I've also done scientists, and I do love doing authors. And I specifically like talking about memoirs, which is why I was so excited to speak with today's guest. He is a fellow at the Radcliffe Institute of Harvard in Journalism and Nonfiction. That's the Catherine A. and Mary C. Gellert Fellow. And he is a writer, author, journalist, lawyer, and former foreign policy advisor. And he has written for the HuffPost and the New York Times and is an alumnus of Queen's University. He is the author of the new memoir, Brown Boy, in which he talks about being born into a working-class Pakistani immigrant family, and what that meant in the context of growing up in Scarborough. And I mentioned that he graduated from Queen's, and he received his master's in philosophy from the University of Cambridge, and a JD, Juris Doctor, from the Yale Law School. And while still at Yale, he worked for the United Nations Special Envoy for Syria on peace talks in Geneva. He has served as a former foreign policy advisor for Justin Trudeau and has held residencies at McDowell and Yaddo and had his essays published in Atlantic, Harper's, New York Magazine, New York Times, and many others, including HuffPost. At Radcliffe, he'll be working on a project that explores the rise of fascism in our time, the resurgence of the far right across the West, and the clear and present dangers facing democracy. He will weave together history, politics, and ideas with reporting from Washington and Berlin, delving deeply into the subjects of white nationalism, Nazism, the modern fascist movement, and the existential threat. We had a great conversation about language, reframing language, politics, U.S., Canada, international, Pakistani versus Indian, what it means to be brown, and just even the overall writing process. This is his first book. How does that compare to, you know, the more short-form writing he's used to? And even maybe one day, will he turn a Brown Boy into a film or a series? His memoir is brown boy, and he is Omar Aziz, and this was our conversation. Omar Aziz, how are you? Hello, how's it going?
It's going all right. How are you?
Doing all right, doing all right. You know, it's finally starting to warm up here on the West Coast. So,
are you in Vancouver?
Victoria.
Victoria.
Yeah.
Even better, right?
Yeah. Allegedly.
Allegedly. I haven't been there, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's small, but it's nice. You know, you make do with what you have, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Speaking of what you have, you are coming out with a memoir, Brown Boy. You know, and for a lot of people, a memoir is all about timing. Why was now the right time for you?
That's a really good question, Dan. And I think that I had originally written some of this when I was in law school as a novel, right? And I found was that fiction requires a common pool of experience, right? So everyone, the same symbols, the same references. And I, after Donald Trump was elected on 11/9/2016, I thought it was very important that I use my personal story in a factual, nonfiction way with the authority and credibility of an author and tell a story that other people hadn't heard before. Because if they had heard these stories, a multiplicity of, say, Muslim narratives or brown narratives, we would not have gotten to the point of discussing a Muslim ban in the United States or rising anti-Muslim sentiment in Canada, etc. Some people have asked me, well, are you too young to write this, or aren't memoirs written later in life? To which I would say historically that was true, but nowadays, like, memoirs have gotten, people want to read them, right? The market wants them, people want them. And when we have a lack of representation that's built up for 200 years, a memoir, which is factual, it actually happened, can be a great literary vehicle for that. Now, ultimately, the memoir itself has to be well written. It has to provide some introspection and some reflection. It cannot just be a woe unto me exercise. But I wanted to write it because we had gotten to a time where people of color, Muslims, brown people like myself, many are vulnerable. And I wanted to write a book that would have resonated with my younger self, who felt very isolated and out of place.
Of course, a large part of this takes place in Canada, in Scartown, after 9/11. We sort of heard a little, you know, if you grew up in that era, you heard the discussions about what it was like in post 9/11 America. But for you as a person of color, what was it like in post 9/11 Canada?
Yeah, I think the hysteria and the fear was definitely very pervasive. And there was a sense in that time, I mean, it's now the 20th anniversary of the Iraq War. There was a sense that Canada would join some of those conflicts. And we did in Afghanistan and elsewhere. Also, our security forces and our police forces were closely, at least our security forces, defense forces were closely with the United States as well. And we knew that there are people, we know that there are people who were caught up in the dragnet of surveillance and intelligence and racism, frankly. Remember Mahar Arar, who was deported to Syria and then tortured there on an alleged basis? You know, just people were basically tortured on accusations alone. If you were a Canadian citizen or a U.S. citizen, natural born, you did have some of a privilege. I was a kid growing up. I would just say there was that sense of fear, you know, and I talk about this in the book, in my household too, because we're Muslim and we go to the mosque. I went to the mosque as a kid every day, and then I'm going to school. And then now you turn on the TV and it's not cartoons and Dragon Ball Z anymore. Remember, I'm 11 years old when 9/11 happens. It's not cartoons anymore. All of a sudden it's news 24/7 and just the most horrific images. And you're being told, or you're hearing, you think as a kid, that you have something to do with this, or your people do. So that is very disorienting. Childhood is difficult enough, right? So
what kind of, if any, conversations did you have with your parents about this, especially since your mom was, by by looks of it, quite devout, and your father was quite secular. I'm curious how those dueling identities played into whatever conversations you might have had around this.
Maybe at the time it was more confusing because my dad was saying things like, well, we have to assimilate and this is a major problem for the Muslim population. Whereas my mother thought that we had to be fearless and we had to worship and we couldn't, this was a test from God. And of course we're not like terrorists. So it's so obvious, right? So that was a bit of a clash that confused me at the time. Looking back on it, hearing those two sides was very informative for me because I got two very different perspectives on basically all the debates that consume us now, from assimilation to integration to respectability politics. And my parents had a disagreement on that front. Again, there was a lot of fear. So they were both trying to protect me, but they took very different approaches to that.
You mentioned this idea of assimilation and integration, and whenever the immigration debate comes up, that's always at the forefront. Should immigrants be required to assimilate? How much of Canadian values do they need to bring into themselves? Where are you? On where do you fall on that? Do people come into this country have a duty to assimilate as much into their society, or can they exist sort of half and half, or in their own world at all?
It's a good question. I think by definition, immigrants do integrate and assimilate because they become Canadian citizens. And also, even if it's a bit of a moot point, because even if they want to cling to their roots and culture and what's familiar, which is a universal experience, right? The Germans and the Irish who came, Eastern European Jews, exactly the same experience. There's literally nothing different, including the racism. We just have a higher threshold now in terms of not tolerating it, right? So immigrants can speak back, so to speak. But at the same time, their kids are going to be integrated and assimilated no matter what. If they're born in Canada or the United States, I guarantee you they're going to be watching hockey, basketball, having the same kind of conversations. I'm a prime example of this, you know. At the same time, we don't want communities of color and immigrant communities self-segregating either, nor do we want to encourage that. We don't want to have segregation by choice. Even if we don't have it, segregation by policy, that is insidious. It's dangerous for immigrants, for people of color, and it gives also a lot of power to white politicians who can then basically control us under a doctrine of multiculturalism. I'm not sure if you want like this interesting conversation, but like there's many layers to this, right? There's many different threads and layers to this. With that said, we're having this conversation. With that said, we're having this conversation at a time of anti-immigrant sentiment. So I want to be mindful of that because you can't really have a coherent debate about immigration when people, there's so much anti-Asian hate. There's this border crisis that's happening as well right now. Perhaps we should be having this conversation more in open in terms of what is our immigration policy? What is the purpose of our immigration policy? What should it look like in the future as well?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, since the pandemic happened, immigration, the debate on immigration, I think, has taken all forms. But you mentioned the word multiculturalism, and I'm curious what that word means to you.
I think the community I grew up in Scarborough was genuinely multicultural. I think you had white people, working class white people, black people, Caribbean, South Asians, East Asians, various and ambiguous and mixed people, so many accents, so many foods, so many colors. So I grew up in this milieu of multiculturalism, of genuine multiculturalism. What we have at the top is not multiculturalism. We have monoculturalism. We have mostly white people who are talking about multiculturalism and where they use people of color often as tokens. Okay. That's how it goes down. Canada is only truly multicultural at the bottom. It's not multicultural at the top. Go look at the boards of our banks. Go look at who's been prime minister. Go look at what the ethnic makeup of political staffers in Ottawa is. This is very clear to me. So multiculturalism to me means genuine interaction and integration of different cultures and different communities, because those collisions is how creativity happens. And that was the original purpose of multiculturalism. Where we are going, the direction in which we are going towards now is top-down managed multiculturalism, often exploited by white politicians to win votes. That's the level that we're going to. They come into our communities often once every 4 years. They come in, they often only serve religious centers and certain community leaders. And often they think of one or two people as the representative of the Tamil community or the South Asian community or the Black community, etc. It's extremely reductive. And I think we need to have a broader, more nuanced conversation about multiculturalism as well that involves people of color and minorities.
And I think that brings to mind the larger immigration debate as a whole. You know, with the war in Ukraine, Trudeau has said that they're, you know, this country is going to take in X amount of Ukrainian refugees. But that kind of, I think, welcoming attitude wasn't necessarily prevalent when refugees were fleeing like Haiti or Afghanistan or Iraq. Where do you think we are today, specifically when it comes to the immigration debate and the discourse around that?
The immigration debate in Canada is that we favor white immigrants and that we disfavor brown immigrants, black, and of course, refugees. That's what it is. That is your answer. And that's what every single person who is honest about this should say. It's so clear to people, right? And we want to dance around the subject, but you can look at the plight of Syrians and the plight of Haitians in this country and the plight of also our own indigenous population in this country. I mean, the statistics kind of speak for themselves here, right? And maybe this isn't even a deliberate racist thing. Maybe it's just a subconscious bias. But I do know that when Russia invaded Ukraine, and this is another part of it, is that Russia launched a land war, an aggressive war in Ukraine, although Russia did exactly the same thing in Syria, right? We took in 25,000, I think 50,000. I mean, this is great for us. Honestly, Dan, it's great. I feel a lot of love and compassion and gratitude for Canada when I think of my story and the story of so many Syrians and refugees. But at the same time, it's a drop in the bucket, and we cannot allow our desire to feel good and feel humanitarian with Syria has millions of refugees. Most of them live in dire refugee camps to this day in Syria, in Jordan and elsewhere, Lebanon. That population will be for 100 years, including Iraq's population too, who will suffer the consequences of the war. And our 20,000 refugees, ultimately, as much as we did far too little. Now, with that said, I think that maybe this is a bit of a subconscious thing too, that because the majority of the population is white, it's easier to be accepting or tolerant of white immigrants. Whereas for people of color, we get associated with, you know, viruses, dangers, terrorism, if you're brown, crime, and the various associations, which again, were done for Jews and Germans and Irish as well 100 years ago. But I think it's deeply troubling. And the reason, one of the reasons why the policy on Ukraine is a little bit different is because for the first time, it wasn't brown people and black people and Muslims who were being bombed and invaded, right? When the countries that we originally come from, right? Countries like Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, so many great Canadians from these places, they were bombed. They had so much violence done to them for so many years. So people came to think that, well, those are just backwards countries and they're always at war. They're always killing each other, etc. These are things that I would hear. So then when you see it happen to white people in Europe, all of a sudden, it's such a shock. Why is it a shock? World War II, Hitler came to power 90 years ago this year. It's not that long ago in human history. World War II is not that long ago. 20 million people, 30 million people died in a European war, young Canadians going, you know, overseas. The 100th anniversary of World War I was not that long ago. So these massive warlike incidents still are happening, but we need to question, why is it our empathy is so selective?
Yeah. Well, you mentioned there, you know, certain things that people think about, you know, the Muslim population. And when you hear experts talk about, Muslims or Islams, especially if they're like religious studies or, people like Dawkins or Harris or a lot of the secular population. One thing that they always say is that the fundamentalists hate the West. How true is that? And where do you think this comes from, this idea that they all hate us because of what we have?
I think this idea was very popular after 9/11. I'm not sure to what extent it's repeated now. Although there's a difference between fundamentalists and extremists, right? Someone can be like a fundamentalist, read the Quran, and be quite apolitical about that. It'd be similar to an evangelical. An extremist is someone who is, encouraging violence or participating in violence, which is very different. I don't think they hate the West. I think they hate themselves. I think that they hate the things that they can't accept. The urges, the impulses. I think they compare themselves to a perfect God in Islam. It's like, imagine the Catholic guilt on steroids, right? Sort of something like that. So they're very tormented and tortured. I grew up in Islam, right? I went to the mosque every day. It's not as glamorous as the people who converted to join ISIS. And by the way, there's also an interesting trend that happened with a lot of white men who were converting to Islam at that point, like to join ISIS, which wasn't that discussed, but that's like kind of weird, right? It's like, why would you? There's so many strands and layers of Islam, from Sufism, Sunni, Shia, Ismaili. There's so many philosophies, there's so much culture and art, and you join like ISIS. So I think it had more to do, I think it had less to do with Islam and more to do with the people who were joining it, right? Because it wasn't just like, oh, you decode the Quran and the ultimate secret to it is that you have to become a terrorist, right? That's clearly not, because there's 1 billion Muslims. And I can tell you that's not av actually, that's there aren't that many violent verses in the Quran compared to in the Torah, for example. Now, those verses were often just misinterpreted, like they were taken out of context. They literally were taken out of context. Like, for example, in the one of the verses about violence to Jews, for example, a lot of people cite this, right? But yet, if you look at the full paragraph, it's saying like it's giving all of these conditions. It's like, when you're sieged, you have to do this. Then you have to offer a peace treaty for 60 days. Then you have to do this. Then you our current armies don't do that. Like, countries are invading each other. There's no peace in Syria or Ukraine. There's no opportunity for an arms negotiation, for a peace deal, for a ceasefire, nothing. So it's giving rules of war. It's not simply you can just take like, oh, you kill the enemy where you find them. Well, that's not what the verse is about. That's not what the paragraph is about. So this is how this trickery was, how a lot of people were getting radicalized. And if you want to know that the whole thing was bullshit, is this Osama bin Laden and the leaders of Al-Qaeda, who apparently believe every word they say, they didn't become suicide bombers. They didn't go to the front lines. They didn't kill themselves. They didn't martyr themselves. If they really believed in heaven and fighting the West and 72 virgins and all the nonsense, then they would have led the charge, but they didn't. They send young 19, 20-year-old men to do it. Another thing I also want to highlight, because I was thinking of this, was how duplicitous a lot of the stereotyping around Islam and the violence in the Quran was. Why is this? Suicide is forbidden in Islam. So they say if you commit suicide, God sends you to hell, because only God can decide when life is given and taken. Why am I bringing up this theological point? Because by extension, if you commit suicide bombing, you're going to go to hell, right? So there were a lot of like political actors that were using ideology and trickery to brainwash people. And that was the phenomenon of ISIS. I think it's a bogus argument to say, well, the Quran has violent verses and therefore people become violent, because there's so many other variables and factors, and culture and politics are very important to them.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, because I think at least from a Western, looking at it from Western perspective, there's often a conflation that people make between Islam and Arab culture. Because, for example, like the largest Muslim country in the world is Indonesia, right? But no one thinks about that. People think about, Saudi Arabia or Iraq or Afghanistan or the Middle East. What can we do to, and which is perhaps where this notion of violence comes from. What can we do to perhaps change the discourse on that at all, if you think that's an issue?
Yes, well, only 20% of the world's Muslim population lives in the Middle East, in the Arab world. And Arabs are Christians and they're Jews and they have other religions as well. So they're predominantly Muslim, but there are divisions within and nuances within. Secondly, I think it's a question for people to ask ourselves. Why is it that we have focused inordinate effort and intellectual energy on the Middle East? Also, middle of what? In East to whom? You know, if you're in India or if you're in China, is the Middle East, is Syria, Iraq, Israel, are they east to you? I mean, and technically the world is round, right? So they will if you go far enough east. But the Middle East is not called the Middle East in India. It's called Western Asia, right? So that even the term Middle East was coined by an American naval captain, actually a very great strategist named Alfred Thayer Mahan in the late 1800s. But it's a term of strategy is what it is. And it was used by the British Empire as well. The Middle East was very crucial because it was the port to India, right? East of Aden, they used to say, the port of Aden. There's a great book by the late scholar Edward Said called Orientalism. Very, very prominent, came out, I believe, in 1979. It really defined a generation of scholars and thinkers. It's worth reading because what Edward Said does in Orientalism is he helps explain why is it that Western thinkers, Western writers, they had this fantasy of the Orient, of snake charmers, magic, Aladdin, you know, all of these, you know, ghosts and jinn and violence and so many tropes. Why is it that those existed? Right. And he goes through Karl Marx, John Stuart Mill, a lot of liberal thinkers as well, who were really, and his conclusion was it was all about power. It was all about control. Right. How do we, I mean, I think just becoming an educated, aware person, you know, not only reading what white people have to say about the Middle East and Islam and stuff, and actually reading from that perspective, having a diversity of friends. This is how you become not just more aware. I mean, it's not just about diversity and inclusion. It's about becoming a cultured citizen. It's become about becoming knowledgeable, being, you know, knowing how other people work, where they come from. This is what it means to live a good life in the 21st century, you know? So think of it like that. It's a journey. And even for white people, I would say, it's all about just exposing yourself, you know, this conversation, other conversations, leading with open eyes, because white people have been fed a lot of lies their entire life, right? So white people also have a tremendous amount of work to do to be free. And I talk about this in my book. And I think some of the conversations around race right now, they're too accusatory and they're too blaming each other and they're too much about scoring points. I went to law school. I don't want to score points with anyone. I did that already. Right. And I think it's much more about let's have a common conversation. There's so many things that you and I have in common, be it, you know, our interests, our desire to learn more, and perhaps books we've read that are separate from race. But those things, being able to actually converse, open our ears and hearts, that's how we actually make progress. It's not me here sitting here and being like, you bad white people. I mean, look, if they're going to put up Confederate flags or if we're going to talk about that stuff, then yeah, sometimes you got to be like, all right, we're going to set the kindness aside because we have some real issues to talk about. Or I'm worried about my safety here, you know,
Right.
there's too many like Confederate flags. But I think really beginning those conversations and where they do become thorny or difficult, don't just like keep up appearances and push it to the side. Let's pretend everything is good, but actually stop and like, let's see what's the disagreement here and can we explore it in good faith?
Does that extend to something like the P word? Because I know you were called that a lot as a kid, and it strikes me that and maybe this is my ignorance, but that's sort of the brown person's N word.
That's right.
If I don't know if you'd agree with that statement, but is that do you find that that's something that is still an issue today, and how do we reframe that language that we use?
So there's many brown people, brown rappers as well, that have reclaimed the word, right? And that they use it among their friends. And I'm not here to judge anyone. I don't use the word. I don't really mess with that word. It originates with neo-Nazis. You know, Prince Harry used that term before when he was younger. Neo-Nazism is re-emerging right now. The people who would use that word who are white would not like me. And I would tell my brown friends who do use the word, I would say it's very different when you're with your homies, you're with your friends, you're kind of cracking jokes. But if there's a white person in the room, or if you're around white people, and now you're giving the message that it's socially acceptable to be saying that word, and someone comes up and says that word to you, trust me, it's going to make you feel different, right? Because there's a context to it. So I don't like that word. I know my brother doesn't like that word. We don't like, it's just, why would I, I don't want to reclaim it. There's plenty of other beautiful words that I've learned since then. And even there's more beautiful slang as well. I mean, the P word, for those who don't know, is Paki. Okay. That's what it is. And it's not a shorthand. It's known in Canada and the UK. People know it's a slur. In the US, often they didn't know it's a slur. So that's another thing. Like, I wouldn't get mad if someone genuinely didn't know, if they thought it was like just a shorthand for like Pakistani, which it's not, right? The term for someone who comes from Pakistan is Pakistani. Okay, it's not what this word is. So if it's like ignorance, then I'm willing to educate, and obviously, I'm not going to get upset. But if it's comes from a place of malice, that's very different. And I think these are also things that dichotomy, that divide is very important. Like if someone is racist out of ignorance, like it doesn't make it better, but at least you could educate them, or it was accidental, or maybe they'll apologize and they'll self-correct. But if someone is racist out of malice, that is a very different thing, right? There's not really too much kindness there. Like, I'm not going to Martin Luther King or Jesus hug someone that wants to destroy me, So I think that's where I differ from some others as well. Like, I don't think you can win a conversation, or win progress, or even with love and kindness with someone who wants to destroy you. Because that's very simple. You have to protect yourself first in your life. But I think that we need to be careful with these words, okay? They mean different things when they're spoken at you, and when you've had them spoken at you before.
You detail in the book about an incident, I think when you were like middle school or something, where you got into a fight over that word. And was there anything else like did you find something like that and other examples where is it difficult to go back and write about a time like that? Just from memory perspective, like how difficult is it to go back and recall that?
No, that's not difficult. That part is not so difficult, because the only difficult part from a writing perspective is just make sure I don't let my emotions get the best of me, right? So in a first draft, you might, if there's anger or frustration coming up, you really want that to come up. It's like I always say you have to write to the bone or write to the vein, right? So you have to allow that to come up. But then at the same time, from a writing perspective, you have to make sure that the scene works. It's not a rant, So it's you revise it, revise it, revise it, but you got to keep the emotions there. At the same time, though, it was kind of hurtful, but I've had a lot of hurtful things happen. And I think, like, people who are genuinely far away from you can't really hurt you like that. Like, they really can't. They can say things, but then if I believe it, then now I've allowed myself to be hurt. Generally, the people who are very close to us are the ones who hurt us, or who can hurt us. So that wasn't as hurtful, but there were times, I guess, maybe when I was writing about queens, when I was just unversed in relationships and love. I mean, heartbreak, I think that was part of that. That was difficult. Obviously, writing about my family, my grandmother, who's not with us anymore, like writing about people who had a huge impact on me that I couldn't see in my real life anymore, that was more difficult, I would say. And just constantly having to, like, kind of go right to the vein and figure out what was the emotion here, even like what's beneath the anger and frustration. Because even if there's a frustrating scene, or a scene that kind of makes me upset, there's an emotion under there that's worth exploring, so.
Yeah. How did your family take this book? Did they respond well to
They love it.
it?
I don't know. They haven't read it. I don't know if they will read it, but they love it. They're happy it's done. No, they've been supportive. They encouraged me. They've been supportive. They stayed out of my way. They knew I couldn't, I think they were just so happy. I mean, my dad came from like Vakant in Pakistan and became a parking officer, Miami Aziz. My mother was a teacher. She came here, she worked at a sweet shop. I was 3 years old in Scarborough. We lived in a bungalow. We lived in a basement, just like messing up in school, bad grades at 17, 18, which wasn't that long ago for me, and then just having this huge shift in life. I'm just so grateful, Dan. Like, when I'm living this life, talking to you, writing these pieces, being at Harvard, like, how can I not? Like, look at this. It's a beautiful life, right? Like, I'm not going to sit here, even when I make my critiques and be like, oh, I didn't, like, I'm not going to sit here and say I'm being oppressed right now. I'm not going to sit here and say I'm a victim right now. But at the same time, I don't believe that just because I've gotten privileged and went to Harvard and Yale and became an author, that I just leave the struggle behind, because I was that person. I didn't have the words. I didn't have the knowledge. I didn't have any credibility. All I knew was that there's these forces in society that are operating still, and I can feel them, you know? So there's many people of color, unfortunately, who, when they do acquire some privilege or prestige, or they make something in the world, they lift the drawbridge or lift the ladder. And I am not one of those people. I think that as soon as you become free, you have to help other people become free as well. Not for your own selfish reasons, or because you have any, desire to be a missionary, but because that is how we expand freedom in this world. You know, it's the people who have made it. That's the story of immigrants. That's the story of all of us.
Do you, given that you grew up in Canada, you went to school in the States, you have a Pakistani background, do you still think at all about what your identity is and where home is for you?
I do think of the question of home. I don't really think of the question of identity anymore, because I'm a blend of so much, right? Like, so much. But clearly, like, I don't have the pin on me right now, but I got this lapel pin with the Canadian and the United States flag on it that the consulate gave me in New York. And that, like, excuse me. That lapel pin sort of sums up what I feel right now. Like, I don't have any desire to go to China. I don't really have any desire to go to Europe. I like Canada, the United States, the political project that we've built. And I think the future of democracy and the world once again will depend on what happens in North America. And we're going to have to carry this whole thing on our back the way we did in the world wars, the way we did constantly, through our economy. And maybe that's bigging us up too much, but I really think that's true, right? Like, Canadians were fighting in World War I from the very beginning. Like, our young men went there thinking they'd be home by Christmas, and they were drawn into a long European war. Those were young guys like us, right? We got to say bye to our families. We're going. Everyone's excited. It's a celebration. We'll see you guys in December. Like, no, this will go on. So yeah, I think it's like it's super important to reflect, and it's super important to just lead a life that is aware, and pursue knowledge as well. So I don't know. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. I mean,
Yeah.
it's always tough. Well, I find it interesting because, people all, if you're anything other than white, right, people will always ask you, oh, where are you from? Meaning, like, even if you were, if you have three generations here, where are
No,
you?
I ask white people now where they're from too, all the
Right,
time. I want to know where did.
no, exactly, because like I was at a show, I think they're now called Hallumination. They're indigenous rappers, right? And I was at the show, and I had indigenous people come up to me and be like, "Oh, where are you from?" Right? And it was the first time I had to think about like, okay, do I say England? Do I say Ireland? Do I like, which? So, I just, I was like, "Oh, Ireland." They're like, "Oh, okay," but it's, and which brings up like, what do you make of sort of that whole reframing of culture that we're maybe going through, and say like, oh, where you're from, or oh, what about this?
I really like it. I think it's hilarious. If we start asking white people where they're from, or if we say that, if we apply the term illegal immigrant, which is a term I don't like, well, then all, every white ancestor is an illegal immigrant, because it's not like they were checking passports back then. So, right, you get what I'm saying? So the language changes. And it's also funny to, like, ironic to be like calling Mexicans illegal immigrants, because a lot of that land was like conquered by the United States, right? So, like, that, a lot of that is indigenous Mexican land, actually. So this thing is confusing and complicated, but I think from a policy perspective, like, yeah, let's ask more of those questions. This society is for all of us. Like, do we agree this is a multiracial, multicultural society that's for everyone, and that you can make it, doesn't matter how you look like? Or do we believe this is a society for white people only? There are some people who believe that. There's some people on the far right who believe that, and that is what their narrative is. So I think more discussion is good, more questions are good, and I'm fine with it. If we can kind of like break these frameworks that like, okay, a white person, when you think American or Canadian, you immediately think white person. When you think like immigrant, you think, you know, brown person somewhere else. There's these kind of subconscious things that go on, and language is a manifestation of thought. So the more that we can contest language, we can also change minds. Now, some people might hear that and be like, it's insidious. I'm like, all language is already politically tinged. If I describe the Iraq War saying the Americans entered Iraq, that's factually true. But it betrays the context, which is the United States invaded Iraq. The United States bombed Iraq. So with our identities as well, people are reformulating language that is more accurate and more responsible too. So when people complain about, oh, woke this, woke that, like it's kind of nonsense actually. Like all we're doing is trying to articulate a more accurate language so we can have an actual conversation to make sure that the playing field is equal, right? So
You know, on that note about language, I'm curious for you from a writing perspective, how much, if at all, maybe the language that you use changed from one draft to another.
that is super interesting. On language, I want to say this book is so much a love letter to books and to language itself, right? This book is about acquiring a language. This book is about living between languages. This book is about what happens when language fails. And for me, I want to, as a writer, I'm always revising. I'm always trying to like go deeper emotionally in what I'm trying to say. Because often you'll write something and you're like trying to say something, it doesn't quite hit. Like you do, and this is a universal problem for your listeners. I want you to know. It gets better. And maybe afterwards we can talk about just some straight up like writing tips as well. But I want to say like the early draft will be very like almost like purging, right? Especially of a memoir because there's emotions and there's like the top level of the story of your life story. Then there's a deep level of the life story, right? And what you're doing, what I'm doing is think I would just write like maybe 100 pages, 200 pages. In my first residency, I wrote 100,000 words. Just to try and get the story out, right? And you gotta, the story is different than you think of it. Like a memoir is not therapy, right? It might be therapeutic for readers, but it shouldn't be therapy for the writer. The writer should have already processed a lot of what has happened. And to the extent that they are processing it, those chapters are most likely going to require extra revision and extra attention, which is okay. But I would say my language grew more refined. I would say my paragraphs grew tighter. I would say I was able to control the narrative and emotions a lot better, right? In the versions that I was writing. So the thing just refines. You have to revise it and then you have to make it better. And you have to do the hard work of cutting things out as well.
So I was going to say, like, how do you decide what stays and what goes?
Well, my great, formidable editor, Kathy Belden at Scribner, once told me that ideas follow anecdotes, right? Ideas serve anecdotes. So when you're writing a memoir and you're writing a scene, at least the kind of memoirs I really enjoy and the ones that really last, but I think the ideas are really prominent. Like, what's the point of the scene, right? Like, what is it showing us? How does it advance the narrative? Some of this is just the ins and outs technique of writing a book. A memoir is a particularly difficult book to execute well from a writer's perspective. And so these are the qu I'm always asking myself these questions, like, what's the idea? What's the larger idea? And sometimes, Dan, it will be like on draft four where the scene wasn't clicking, and somehow, like, I had a good walk that day, or I didn't look at it for a long enough period that my brain took a fresh approach, and it just clicks. It's like, oh. And sometimes it's like three sentences that I'll add, and I'm like, done, you know? So I think that's really, really important. I would say, yeah, focusing on craft and structure, if you're a writer or any kind of artist, podcaster, creator, will do wonders for you, you know, because you, at a minimum, will keep improving. So I kept improving as I was writing this. I was not the same writer at the beginning that I was at the end. You know, I was not the same writer in the first draft than I was in the last draft. I was constantly being pushed. I was pushing myself. I was trying to continue to refine, refine, refine. So I think readers will enjoy it. You know, I think it makes for a good read. Like my belief is, and this is from a structural perspective, and I don't want to give the magic trick away like that, right? But it is, I think it's a book that at only 300 pages goes deep. but it moves quickly as well. And those things are difficult to pull off. I didn't want a book that dragged at any point. So there might be times where readers are like, oh, I want more of this or that. But I'm like, we got to keep this thing moving too. And a lot of that, again, takes years, right? It takes years of the writing and revising itself. If you do a good job. I mean, I had a lot to learn as I was working on this memoir too.
Do you have a particular process? You know, like, do you write, you know, this time of day, X amount of hours? You know, you want to get X amount of pages done in a certain day or a certain week.
Usually I write every day. I mean, these days, even like I'll be doing podcasts and conversations and interviews and I'm not writing as much. So I get anxious. Like that kind of tells you, right? There's something wrong with us. I think I'll like do like 10 things. And then if I didn't write that day, I still feel guilty. I say like, usually I try and write as much as I can when something comes to me. When I'm in book mode, I really lock in though. You know, right. Like I really, really lock in. As from the moment that I get up, I'm working on it. I'm revising it. I'm structuring my life around it. I'm going on walks. I'm keeping the outside world away from me. Conversations that could kind of corrupt my energy. I lead with emotion. I'm quite sensitive when I'm in that creative state as well. And I might just be like rereading things like authors that I really love that inspired me. But yeah, it's about really pushing myself and doing the best. And honestly, Dan, just being like, if someone is going to spend 2 weeks or a weekend or whatever reading me, whether it's a piece in the New York Times or the Globe and Mail, or whether it's this book, I want to make sure that I've laid everything on the line. I've checked everything. I've rewritten everything. I've cut my darlings that only were there for my ego. I've left in the good stuff. Like I've really, from a craft perspective and an author artist perspective, I really go the extra, extra, extra mile so that it's a good representation for me and it's worth your time.
You know, a lot of, you know, Hollywood loves true stories. And it struck me when I was reading it that there is something a little kind of cinematic about the story and the way you write. I'm curious, has that something that's crossed your mind at all, turning Brown Boy into like a film or a miniseries or anything?
Yeah, it has. And I was talking to this director friend of mine, Laura Checkaway, who was actually, she was nominated for an Oscar. And I've thought of it, but I think I've thought more about the perils of it. I've just seen a lot of great books turn into bad movies, bad series. I've seen writers try and do another job. Now, directing and filmmaking and cinematography, those are things I already have interests with and I'm already playing around with, right? So I would view it as like, if it was the right creative opportunity and the right creative collaboration, I'm not saying I have to be behind the camera or anything like that, but I would obviously want to have creative input. I thought of it, but honestly, not as much, and probably not as much as other writers. I'm like, I grew up such a purist writer. I love films, but at the same time, like, how many movies can you think of that really lived up to the book or right, like surpassed the book, right? So there's a few, but they often exist as like good art and creation and content in their own right, right? So like the Harry Potter films are great. Like don't really compare them to the book. The book is better. It's a different experience, but the films are great for films, right? So I think I'm thinking of it more along the lines of a creative craft project. And if that opportunity presents itself, it would have to be the right one. I wouldn't just like, oh, let's turn this thing into a movie just for the sake of it.
Right. But maybe one day, you know, write a screenplay or a documentary or something on a different project rather than your book.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I have filmmaker energy for sure. I've got director energy for sure. I don't really need to be an actor. I mean, I'm cool. Well, I wanted to be an actor when I was younger, actually. When I was a kid, my dad was like, oh, you should be an actor. And so, no, I'm interested in directors. You know, I really like the people who make the thing. I like people who write the thing, the script writers. Yeah. So we'll see about that as time goes on. You know, I'm going to LA next month too for this book festival. So we'll see. The creative instincts are for sure there, but I don't want to like talk myself out of, you know, I don't want to like get ahead of myself either.
You know, I'm saying like I went to theater school, right? And sort of now do more behind the scenes stuff. So I in terms of energy, I completely get it.
All right. Well, at some point, maybe not on this podcast, I'm going to have to pick your brain about what you know and what you've learned, because think a good way to approach, I mean, for your listeners to think of it, like, you know, to have that beginner mindset, no matter what you do, like think of it. I got this book, I've written for all these places and stuff, but at the end of the day, when I got to write a piece, me and the blank page, you know,
right.
Beginner mindset, always learning. So That's the same energy that I apply to writing and to all my creative endeavors.
Do you, and I guess just in terms of, energy, like you do a lot of, pieces for like the New Yorker, for example, is your
Not the New Yorker, New York Times,
New
New
York
York
Times, sorry.
Magazine. Yeah.
Is your, is there a different mindset doing that than writing a book? Because, a book is going to be a much longer term project than an essay or an opinion piece.
There really is no comparison. There's not. I mean, just because you can write a piece does not mean that you can write a good book. And sometimes it goes the other way. Like, there can be authors who might have written great books, but like, you ask them to write an 800-word op-ed, and that's tough, right? I love both. Both, like, pieces just electrify me because it's like 900 words or 1,000 words, maybe 2,000 words. And so your structure, your frame is very contained. So within that, you can dance beautifully, right? You can, like, I love to surprise people in my pieces. Like, maybe I'll include a quote or something, right? So that people, they're reading it on their phone, they're busy, so they feel delighted, and if not inspired, then they learn something as well from the piece. And I try and keep the sentences tight. For a book, though, it's a long marathon, right? Like, you cannot write a book in a day, and most likely, unless you're like cocaine fueled, like Jack Kerouac, and like chained to the table, you might not be able to write it in a week either. So it's a long race. So that means you have to manage your energy and be able to come back to it every day. A lot of that is managing motivation, confidence, and inspiration, because I can sit here and get inspired for a piece and just now crank it out. But if I'm going to write a book, it might take me 6 months of writing, might take me 2 years. So you have to make sure you're really doing it for the right reasons. A lot of people these days, Dan, like, they write books to like celebrities and other influencers. They'll like write books to just like sell and promote a product, but they're not really like, the book isn't really a book, right? It's just like a bunch of pages glued together with some words in it. And I think, like, for the real authors, for the real writers, for people who actually want to write, it's important to know your motivation and why you want to, and then to be able to maintain that for a longer period of time, and also deal with the peaks as well as the valleys.
Do you think there's a novel in your future at all?
Yeah, for sure. I was actually working on a novel in Yale Law School. I have an idea for one. I mean, I've been turning it over in my mind. I really, really, really like it. And that's why I'm not going to talk about it.
Fair. No, I know. Sometimes it's best to keep your ideas close to your chest until they're ready to manifest themselves in
That's
whatever
true.
in
That's
whatever.
true for strategic reasons. That's true for strategic reasons because, you might share an idea with a friend and they have some like under, they're having a bad day, or maybe they were always secretly jealous of you and they give you some like calm down energy, or they knock your idea down. Like, for someone like me, that could be really bad because the idea could be amazing, right? And I'll get discouraged. So that's one reason. But the other reason is also you want your ideas to be able to marinate and to grow, right? Like, sometimes good ideas are like good wine. You just got to let the time pass a little bit, right? Don't talk about it. Like, just let it age in your mind and it's going to mature a little bit. And when it's time, and this is where maturity comes in, like where intuition comes in, and you get better over time as you grow, is that your intuition gets better, so you'll know when to jump on the idea, right? You talk about timing. That's what we talked about. Like, timing is so, I mean, it's so idiosyncratic, it's so serendipitous, that it's sometimes when you try and time things too much, you might just, it might come off as forced. So you have to be good at like realizing when it's time to go with an idea.
Is there, for people who may read this book, whether they're, brown or they're white or, whatever culture or ethnicity they may be, is there one or two things that you would want them to take away from this, from your experience?
Yeah, I would say that people who look different than you probably see a different world. Like, we don't just see the world differently, we also see a different world, right? So I'm thinking there's just so many examples. But if you see a police officer, for example, or customs, it's a different experience. I'll just say that. And you should probably be, if you don't realize that it's a different, very different experience and a very different world that we see and interact with, then you got to read more books, I think, explore more. That's one part, just the description differences in reality. So in this book, you're in my head, right? So you can kind of like, I'm trying to give you an HD image of what it was like seeing the world through my eyes. And that might be a totally new experience for people. That might be very familiar to other people, but it's written in a way such that both groups of people would come away learning something, right? I think another takeaway is just the importance of books and learning. Like, I think our culture is going backwards. People learn too much on TikTok now. Like, you have to be able to sit down with a book, like expand your mind. You know, we have access to the greatest intellectual resources and libraries, information that would have made the kings and queens of Europe in the 1800s, right, salivate thinking how much us ordinary people would have access to, and yet we waste it. So I think even when I was going to college, going to Queens, there wasn't this level of social media and knowledge available on the internet. So I would say, like, really, people should, like, the takeaway is that there's beauty in knowledge. There's beauty in the pursuit of knowledge. There's beauty in creativity, and that the person that you are today is not necessarily the person that you're going to be 5 or 10 years from now. I think of how different my life went, and I think that each person, we have the power to self-create. And I think, isn't that beautiful? Right? Like, we live in a free country. We can self-create, whether you have resources or not. If you don't have resources, you can begin to apply this beautiful brain that we've been given. You know, you begin, like, no one starts at 100, right? Like, no one starts at 100. You don't write a book in a day. You don't do a podcast in a day. You don't make a movie in a day. So it's going to take time. Delay gratification, you know, read good books like Brown Boy, read some other good books, and then think about, like, your place in society and your history, and how can you lead with kindness and knowledge, and again, spreading the arc of freedom for us all, right? There's plenty for all of us. So
Well, the book is Brown Boy, and it is being released April 4th,
fourth.
I do believe, through Simon and Schuster, and you can pre-order it now on Amazon.
Yes, indeed.
Omar Aziz, thank you so much. This was great.
Thanks for having me, Dan. I really appreciate it.
Alrighty, take care.
Cool.
And that was my conversation with author, journalist, intellectual Omar Aziz. His new memoir is Brown Boy. It is out April 4th, published through Scribner. You can pre-order or order your copy now. That does it for me today. My thanks to Omar Aziz. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Bye.